Good evening. Welcome to what is a landmark event for NEABPD. We are having our monthly seminar, whatever we want to call it. Charlie and Kelly have graciously given their time for I don't know how long, but this is a unique opportunity for all of us who will be on the line. We're delighted to start the first of this series called Connecting the Dots. We have Dr. Charlie Swenson and Dr. Kelly Kerner who are going to be doing an informal hour with us, talking about whatever they feel they'd like to talk about and whatever they'd like to share with us. So we're incredibly lucky to be able to have this opportunity because these are two leaders in the DBT field from way back when, from venture to stay a good 25 years ago. So before I turn it over to Kelly and Charlie, I do want to let you know that they've set a bar for something that's very exciting. We now have Dr. Blaise Aguirre and Dr. Jillian Galen who've decided that they'd like to also contribute their time in their two-week mindfulness course with us starting April 15th and April 22nd. So for those of you who'd like to be on that call, please send an email to neabpd@aol.com, and the subject is mindfulness, and put your name and phone number on that. It's my pleasure now to turn this over to Kelly and Charlie, and thank you to both of you.
Thanks, Perry.
All right. Well, you know, we're actually going to start with tonight's theme music, so if I can do this right, just one second.
Sail silver! A fiery horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty hi-yo silver! The Lone Ranger! This is the legend of a man who buried his identity to dedicate his life to the service of humanity and country. It is the story of the origin of the Lone Ranger. Early settlers in the West had to be brave men and women, ready to fight for their lives at any moment.
Okay, do you hear it, Kelly? When's the last time you heard that?
I totally see where we're going with this. Yeah. You go, Charlie. I'm right behind you here.
Right. You're Tonto, you said. You'd be Tonto. You know, there is the part that introduces the origin of Tonto comes in about 4 or 5 minutes, but I couldn't figure out how I can cut from one to the other. I'm not that technological. So it's possible that whatever we're talking about, in about 3 or 4 minutes, I'm going to suddenly cut in and we're going to hear Tonto enter. because, you know, when we agreed to talk about, to do this, and the topic was beginnings, and I, among other things, I started thinking about the beginning of relationships and actually also the beginning of this show, whatever we're going to call this. As I said earlier today, it's sort of a reality show. I started thinking about the Lone Ranger, which, you know, we may go back a lot of years teaching DBT and me before that psychoanalytic treatment. But this little episode came from about 74 years ago. So I thought that was fun to go back and think about, and I realized I didn't know how the Lone Ranger and Tonto began, but now I do, and we've heard all the episodes that I can find. So anyway, I just thought I'd play that, and that we're off and running with this topic of the origins of things and the beginnings of things, and I think connecting that to the beginning of therapy relationships and other associated topics. So I know you and I have each thought a lot about this in the past couple weeks. And I wonder if you have any thoughts right now just in reaction to going over the Lone Ranger and starting this show.
Yeah, you know, it does. It makes me think this may have been. Did you listen as a radio show to The Lone Ranger, or did you start watching on TV?
Well, actually, I listened first on the radio in the very early 50s, and we didn't have a television until I was about 7. But we used to listen. We had a big radio in our living room, and we would listen to things at night. And this was one routine show, and then, of course, became a TV show.
Yeah, so that's what, I guess that was my association with, it's cool. This may be actually the origins of this conversation, you know, are somewhat back there in how engaged you were listening to the show. That's mm-hmm. I just think it's really interesting. And the music I just loved.
You do, yeah. Yeah.
I have a very positive association to that. And I remember watching it as a kid, too.
No, I think one of the things when I was thinking about how things begin, and especially how relationships begin, was that, and then I realized I didn't know how it began, but I knew a lot about the Lone Ranger and Tonto. And then I thought, I was actually trying to think back on another thing, which is where you and I began to know each other. And it was hard to remember that either. I feel like the very first moments, the beginnings of things happen without you realizing it at the time that this is a new, you know, you don't quite get at the time. You look back and designate a starting time of a relationship, but actually there may have been something before that. I don't know if you... I remember you teaching a workshop with me the first time we ever taught together.
Do you?
In Northampton, Massachusetts.
Really?
I don't think you were quite done with your internship at Pittsburgh.
Wow.
And you hadn't taught DBT for a year, and you got slated to teach a workshop with me, and you really felt bad about it. Because at the time you felt like you didn't. I thought you were great, but you felt like you had kind of lost your kind of be on top of everything.
Oh, wow. I don't remember that, but I do remember, actually, it's really interesting. The one I really remember you at is also early. It was teaching in Illinois, and a true, total failure of teaching. And I don't know if you remember this, but I was the lead off with you and Cindy Sanderson and Alan Frazetti.
Alan Frazetti, that's right.
Yeah.
Tom Lynch
and
was there as his student.
I had to lead the whole thing off and give a lecture on diagnosis. Do you remember this?
I don't remember you. I remember you were there, and that was an amazing training with 5 trainers there and all of these people, about half of whom were made to go there. You know,
wow.
And it was
I'll
the beginning of...
I'll tell you this story later about this one, because this is a formative experience.
Oh.
It might be a really good one about beginning, though, because that's the beginning for me of actually developing as a teacher. So we can come back to that one.
Yeah. Well, I remember that, and I remember you being there. And then I remember you and I teaching in England at an intensive.
Yeah, I remember that.
You remember that? Do you remember Scottish team, these 8 people that sat in the back of the room and talked in ways that we couldn't understand, and they had a riotous sense of humor. They thought everything we did was funny, but we didn't know why. And their language was enough different that it was really hard to get it. But it was a great time teaching with you.
That was a great time. It was.
Yeah, so their origins there. And another origin of this show, speaking of Cindy, and I've mentioned this on this Sunday evening call-in series with Perry, the first one that I did of 2, I made a little tribute to Cindy Sanderson, but just to repeat a little tiny bit of that, just that for me, this show comes out of the fact that when Cindy Sanderson died, she was in a hospital bed in Springfield, Massachusetts, and she had been my best friend for years, and she had come up, she had moved to Northampton from New York, had been cancer-free for over 5 years. And when she moved up, one of the reasons was that we were developing a radio show. And we thought we would do a radio show that would be kind of like a car talk, a psych talk, some kind of thing, because we had done so much teaching together, and it was really fun. And we thought, what a great venue, and some people encouraged us. So But then she got, her cancer came back 3 weeks after she moved to Northampton.
Oh.
And she battled it again. It was 11 years by that point from her initial diagnosis. And then when it got to finally about 13 months later, and it was clear she was dying, and she was lying there in the hospital bed. She really couldn't open her eyes. You weren't sure whether she could hear you anymore. So it was really the last thing I got to say to her that she, it turned out she, you could tell she heard, because she opened one of her eyes sort of strugglingly and looked over at me, and it looked like wrinkled her corner of her mouth in a way that was like a smile. But what I said to her was, by the way, Cindy, I just want you to know we're scheduled for our next intensive. And then there paused, and then I said, and we're going to do our radio show in heaven. And she smiled. That's when you could tell she was smiling sort of in one eye opening. She looked over at me. And that was really the kind of the last contact. So in a concrete way, to me, this is that, you know, something like nine plus years later. So it has quite a meaningful origin to me. And it's very meaningful to do this with you, because there wouldn't be many people I think I could really just do this with that I'd feel comfortable enough to just talk.
I feel so touched.
Did you know that story, Kelly?
I did not know that story. I feel really touched and moved. Yeah.
Well, you taught with Cindy.
Yeah. No, I do. I remember. My favorite memory is we were doing a very serious role play. I was modeling how to do suicide risk assessment and really help somebody back from the brink. And I think I was therapist, or I can't remember now who was the therapist, who was the client. But we're in front of 80 people at in Brown University, I think, on the campus there in Rhode Island. And all of a sudden, Cindy reaches in her pocket and she comes out and she has a finger puppet.
Oh, yes, right.
And she continues on the conversation, but talking in a high voice through the finger puppet.
Yes. She's,
Jesus.
She was probably the therapist then.
Yeah, she's so special.
We missed the whole Tonto thing, but I got immersed in this. So, I think one of the things that's a little tricky is that you and I were talking this afternoon, and I realized, you know, we're going to do this in the future too, that it's a plus and a minus that we talked this afternoon, because we already were kind of into talking about some of these things. But I think if we just jump in, we'll get back into some of what we were talking about.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I found the quote I was mentioning to you from Henry Miller, since then, and what it says, and it's sort of what I think we're doing. All growth is a leap in the dark without benefit of experience. And to me, it's kind of like other things you were saying about trying to break patterns or trying to do something new or different, that almost any time you do that or ask a client to do that, for instance, or anyone in a relationship, it's really challenging, kind of scary for me to do this kind of leap and silence some of my critical voices in my mind just to do it.
I feel the same way. I was thinking actually a lot about that, about one of the best questions one of my supervisors gave me when I was just starting was to ask, to use the beginning of therapy as a chance to ask the client to explore, and for me also to revisit, how do you start things? You know, what patterns do you have as you begin?
Mm.
You know, and just to reflect, and this leaping quality, sort of just saying yes, even though it's unknown, made me think a little bit, what you were just saying made me think about in acceptance and commitment therapy, there's a lot of talking about this particular type of move, as a verb, as a willingness, as a something you do and that you could practice, and this leap that you could, really, you can do the move even if it's a piece of paper. You could stand on a piece of paper and jump. You know, it's the same behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think there's something about that.
I was going to ask you that because, you know, you're familiar very with acceptance and commitment therapy and functional analytic therapy and as well as DBT and some other CBT treatments. And I wondered, like, take acceptance and commitment therapy. Is there kind of a way of describing how you do begin that's different than other therapies? I mean, how do you start? Do you just start like anything else, or is there a certain kind of prescribed way?
I don't know that there would be a prescribed way. I think that there is a common entry point often, and again, I wouldn't say I'm an expert. I'd say I'm in the intermediate range, working hard to develop expertise in the model sort of person.
Mm-hmm.
But this, I think, similar in some ways to the commitment sessions in the DBT framework of really having a genuine, heartfelt conversation with a person about where do they struggle and what are they trying to do with mm-hmm. that struggle
mm-hmm.
and how is it working. And this phase is often, or this type of work is called creative hopelessness. It's where the person might literally run into the ways in which the current ways of responding to emotional distress, certain ways of thinking, certain ways of acting, really continue to dig the hole deeper. They don't actually work when you look at them. And out of that sort of, you know, really hitting bottom, so to speak, is how I feel when you really watch a skillful person do it, they are in their shoulder to shoulder with the person's looking at how they're dealing with their life and seeing, okay, this is not working. And then there's the building of, okay, so mm-hmm. what if this therapy was about something else? And then there's an opening into the rest of the ways ACT might approach things. But I mm-hmm. actually feel in some mm-hmm. ways it's really interesting. We did a really interesting conversation with Lucine Wisniewski and then Emily Sandoz, where Emily is an ACT person and Lucine is a CBT-DBT person. And they mm-hmm. both had a beginning session with a client who had eating disorder. I think it was anorexia. They did a role play. And mm-hmm. there's so many similarities and then a lot of differences. It was subtle. So that's my broad stroke, you know, kind of what might be different. But I don't know if it would really catch the nuance of how the therapies might differ.
Well, you know, as you talk, I mean, and I think about I mean, I'm familiar with those models, but the ones I really have practiced with some expertise, I guess, are DBT and psychoanalytic treatment and then family systems treatment a long time ago, and I still do some of that. But in DBT, it was very nice in the early years of practicing that there was, you know, you could go to the book and see, okay, these are the things you do. The beginning. I mean, after an assessment's done and you're getting started, and you can get, you know, these in Marcia's book, you get these captions with things. Do this, 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 and this, and this, and this, and now you're using these strategies, and now you're on to commitment strategies, and it's sort of that. So compared to my original model, where you really there was much more space in between interventions in your thinking anyway. And here there was a lot, but what I've learned over the years is that it still only informs about, you know, 5 or 10% of what I do.
Mm-hmm.
So that what's tricky, because it's an evidence-based treatment, is that at any given moment in any session, including the very beginning, you know, what's the evidence-based intervention at that moment?
Mm-hmm.
You've got a choice of, you know, thousands of things you could do at that moment, and then you've got others that are beyond description. They're very having to do with a certain level of attunement and interest and involvement, and so it really is. It's really good because it gives a lot of guideposts and a lot of suggestions. But I think you miss the point if you think it's really telling you what to do in the interstices of those guidelines. You still have to be a person.
Yeah.
You know, you still have to get somebody to get, as my wife once said, there. You know, therapy, she's a really good therapist, and she said, it's, you know, there's only two things you do in therapy. You hook them and you cook them. And I always liked that because, you know, it's sort of, it's the antithesis or it's the other end of the dialectic between having a book with 100 and some strategies. It's like, oh, yeah, there's only two. And when you only have two, of course, it opens up the door for a wide variety of ways of improvising and in order to hook them. And you do have to hook them. I mean, in DBT, yeah. the agreement, the commitment, the orienting, the being there, you know, you really, if you're going to have a successful treatment, you, it seems to me, well, that might not be entirely true. I mean, I've been through a couple of CBT treatments as a patient, and, you know, I was already hooked before I got there because I knew what I wanted. Mm-hmm. So I do think, you know, the therapist was not that, he didn't really hook me in a certain way, but I was ready to be hooked enough that he didn't have to do much. I was like the fish ready to jump in the boat.
I think that whole this quality of hooking, there's something that is exactly right, and then it also is making me think about the quality of leading versus following. You know, coming in with, and when you said attunement earlier, the way you mm-hmm. you might come in prepared, almost with an agenda at the beginning mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. a therapy versus more of an attunement and a following. And I definitely think that there's some, you know, sweet spot in there that varies person to person, because it was making me remember I had this one teenager once where I did have an agenda. The way the referral had come was quite complicated. I really felt like, okay, wait, we need to get a few things straight here, sort of quality. And I came in with more agenda than typical. And mm-hmm. And I watched how, you know, it's like dangling a lure or something. You know, she was not biting. mm-hmm. And folding and making those cranes. And at some mm-hmm. point, I said, there's something happening over there. There's just, and she gave me a smile. You know, finally I was, like, tuning in. And I said, it's just not happening, is it? She said, no. Uh-uh. Mm. I have a lot of people in my life who have an agenda. I kind of wanted to come in here and see, were you going to be one of those? And you know, and she was excited. The best supervision I got, I think, that whole year.
You know? Yeah.
She left me the cranes, and I keep them on my, actually, I have this little shelf that's almost like an altar practically, but, you know, my little mm-hmm. lessons, and they uh-huh. sit right up there because there's some quality of that attunement. And it can't be a hook like a lure, you know, like it actually has to be a hook. This is the part where I feel like with DBT and ACT, it's very similar. It actually has to reach into the person's deepest desires for themselves, and that's mm-hmm. what you're hooking or pulling forth or allying with or rallying around, you know, the things that the person may have even just given up on is not possible anymore.
You so, know, I think that's right. With the people I've worked with that have not been easy to hook, and I'm thinking of three different ones right now, and you and I have already agreed there's a little tricky talking yeah. here knowing there's other people listening to share confidential material about people. So I can say this in certain general terms, but in one case, I went in, and the person's usual problem behavior was so disturbing to me that I that was really, I just, it was just hard to sit there and hear, and I could see effects of it and to hear, and it was like, oh my God. And it was very early in my career. This is actually when I was a resident, with nothing to do with DBT, but I think the basic human process that we're talking about has to be there in any treatment that I've ever been in or been part of. And this, with this person, I went to a supervisor and been in about 1977 or 78. And he, his response was really good. And of course it's easy, you know, in psychoanalytic treatment, I think you get more of this. But he said, I don't think you can really start with him until you get what it's like to do that mm-hmm. and what would drive him to do that. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, my God. It's really hard. Like I said, I want to say it here because it was kind of like it was identifiable if anybody ever knew this person. And it was like, oh, my God. But I thought looking back on that moment, you know, that many years ago, I think that was great supervision right then. Mm-hmm. I really did try to just be able to think of that. And I think that's one thing is try to think your way in. To it. Other times, I don't think it doesn't really work, at least for me. It works almost, you don't know what is going to get you in. You don't know what's going to create that connection because you don't know the person yet. So I think you do a lot of trial and error while you're doing, at least in DBT, the standard strategies. I just think they just cover what you're doing technically, but there's also a kind of a human process of trial and error. I mean, I could do the same six commitment strategies with somebody in a certain 5-minute segment, and in one case, really get connected, and which helps with commitment. And in the other one, I might do fabulous commitment strategies, and they wouldn't be connected, and less likely to be committed. So it's sort of like, I just think getting these connections. One person wouldn't speak to me for almost 3 months. On a weekly therapy, and at the point that this person first spoke, it was because I came in, nothing was working. I had been encouraged by my DBT team to stick with it when I was just feeling like this is not going anywhere. And lo and behold, at this point with this person, I shared something of my own experience with my 2-year-old son and something bad that had happened the day before. And immediately this person was asking me all about it that I never would have known. But I think that was 3 months into therapy was what I thought of as the beginning of our therapy. And this person went on and just talked a blue streak. So it was
so interesting. Haven't you been in that spot, too, where really you, I don't know, I mean, it'd be really interesting to know what was important to that person, but, you know, where you, part of it might be a test, like just to see, can you stand it? Part of it might be, like, transmitting to you, like, this is how it actually is, like, you know, now you're getting what it's like to me, or what was up?
I was, I alluded to it earlier today that I mean, I think I've been in that spot a number of times, and I think I've been in a couple of therapies where I didn't get hooked. But I was in, you know, my wife worked, she and I worked together on this inpatient unit in White Plains. And we had worked together for nearly a year. And we liked each other, respected each other, but there wasn't that kind of connection until what I think of as the beginning of our relationship, which is one day I was wearing contact lenses those days. And I was wearing contact lenses, like I suppose a lot of people, I don't know what other reason people do wear contact lenses. There's probably a lot of reasons, but at least for me it had to do with thinking that it made me look better. And so I think, you know, I thought, and I felt, you know, I was kind of a geek in high school. I felt like I didn't seem to knock anyone dead. And so I thought, well, I'll try to wear these contact lenses. And they were never fully comfortable. I always was aware of them in my eyes, kind of like a person would have tinnitus that's always there. So there's always this comfort, but I thought, well, it's worth it. And I'm, you know, it was early years of working at that hospital. And she, one day, I came wearing my glasses because there was something off with my contacts. And she said, God, I really like how you look with your glasses. I said, you do. And I thought it was going to be this conventional thing. Yeah, you look more like a professor or teacher or something like that. But I said, why do you like it better? And she said, because your eyes look more real. Mm. And I thought, whoa, you know. I had been feeling ever since I tried contacts that I was more comfortable wearing my glasses, not having contacts in. And it's just that moment. Who could have known who could have known that that moment she spoke to something that was really significant to me, that she sort of saw through, and it made a connection. So I think I look for that. When I'm working with patients and I don't feel at the beginning that we've gotten very far, we might have gotten far on paper, but I don't feel like the person's in, you know, and motivated by wanting to work with me. I feel like I was reading something, I don't know if you probably never knew this. Did you ever hear of a therapist named Semrad?
No, but Charlie, you know, before you went there, I actually am really curious about your person who was quiet. Why did she then, what reached her? Could we go there for just a second?
The one that I shared for three months,
and then you share something that's difficult, that's personal, and then it actually somehow is enables her to then talk, or do you think?
I think with this person, now having known how everything unfolded after that, as a teenager too, she regarded being in therapy as, even though she came, I mean, the thing that kept it going is she kept coming, which was amazing, because she refused to do most everything else in her life. But there she was, and she's not even looking at me, never eye contact, would sit sideways, and I'd look, and I would try to connect. I'd say, you know, I wonder what your week was like. No answer, you know. You know, I wonder, I'm just impressed that you keep showing up. And then I would try this, and I would try that. But it was all me focused on her in various ways, trying almost like fishing, you know, putting a hook in the water, and nothing's there except a lot of cynicism and what looked like just moments of contempt towards me. Me trying to just, I think part of why the therapy ended up finally happening is I tolerated the contempt, what felt like contempt. Who knows what it was? But I think what happened was, for the first time, it was the first moment that actually I shared something that indicated my own vulnerability and my child's vulnerability. And immediately, it was possible for her to jump in and start asking questions. And I became like the patient. That wasn't a sort of a conscious strategy. I was just thinking, you know, I should just talk about something that I really, you know, and thinking and feeling. So I just started to tell the story of what happened to my son and me the previous day. And so it really aroused great interest and still some mistrust. But I think it's that, Kelly. I mean, look at I went to a camp, you know, it's called the Hole in the Wall Gang camp in Connecticut once. You ever hear of that? It's one of these camps that Paul Newman was the philanthropist for. A lot of his Newman products, this is what they went for, was this camp in Connecticut and then many others. And I went there about 16 years ago for part of a summer as a volunteer counselor. And what impressed me was that the first night at dinner, which was 120 kids, all the counselors in this fabulous big outdoorsy building. We're all in there, and to break the ice, they wanted to indicate kind of what the rules were. They wanted to talk, but what they did was every counselor broke one of the rules in a way that looked absolutely spontaneous. Like it looked like, oh no, this one screwed up. Oh, now look at that one. That one walked in the middle of someone else when they were talking, you know, and that one made a lot of noise when he got up from his table when something else was going on. And just one after another, every counselor screwed up. And then they handled it and they tolerated it. And it made for a lot of laughter. And I think a real sense of the counselors are vulnerable, but they're vulnerable and they recover. And I think I can think of other therapy situations where, you know, that's what I think made it possible to get started. But it isn't in the manual. It's not in any manual I've seen. It's like, here, tell stories about yourself. you know, or, you know,
yeah,
make a mistake.
I think there is some, I would say, in definitely in functional analytic psychotherapy. There's
really?
Some, and, yep, and I think there's also some in some of the Paul Gilbert stuff on compassionate mind, compassion-focused therapy, shame-prone individuals. I think there is something. There's something about that showing of vulnerability and the spaciousness and the, you know, getting as many of the aversives out of there. It's just really interesting to me what you're saying.
But
so sorry to interrupt you. Go back to tell me.
No. When you say showing vulnerability in functional analytic therapy, does it prescribe? Does it just generally say this would be a good idea? Are there techniques? Are there recommendations? Because I really think this is huge. I think that even when you don't show vulnerability in the way that, I mean, the way I just said it was a very big, obvious one. But there are a lot of other ways that you just show you're impressionable because you're so...
Yeah, that you're open, yeah.
You're open, you're vulnerable, you are attuned, you are present, and therefore you are impacted. And the person can feel that, you know what, you're not just administering a therapy. And I think it's... So anyway, with functional analytic therapy, you think there's...
Well, yeah, so a group of us are actually Mavis I, Bob Kohlenberg, and then a group of people who are expert in that have been doing a series of evaluating the training of therapists. And what's, at least for me, has been fascinating. I've been both a participant, you know, person in the training as a participant and as a co-trainer. And the way that we've, Mavis primarily, has set up the... she and then Jonathan Cantor, I think, are main architects of the way the training is running. You, as a therapist, you do every single exercise you're going to be asking your client to do. And there's something about that degree of vulnerability of really doing an exercise yourself and then knowing you're going to share it with your peers who are in the class that, for me at least, it changed the context. You know, stimulus value, like I felt so much more sensitive to how hard it is to begin therapy, how hard it is to make a disclosure, the ways in which you really need to be met, not just with understanding, but some way where there isn't one up, but they're human too, like you really get the direct experience of being in the same boat. So we can talk more about it, but I think that this, there's something really powerful about what you're saying. I think there's something about straight shame prone, maybe more than others, but this sort of deliberately, you know how animals will show their neck or they'll make it clear in a body way that there's no threat? I think you actually have to do those different things.
Well, I think that that's important. You know, I was I mentioned to you that I had read this book called Click.
Oh, and, yeah. I want to hear more about that. Yeah.
And Click, it's by these two brothers, Ori Brofman and Ram Brofman, and Click is about, it sort of collects a lot of social psychology research on how do people click, whether it's friendships that last for a long time and you just feel like very alive in it, or it's romantic relationships that really click, and that create a sense at the time or looking back on it as if you were in a kind of magical state. There's sort of like something beyond just saying, oh yeah, that person and I have a lot in common. And it's that feeling that probably everybody has had with certain people or certain situations where you just think, oh wow, that really took me over. They call it quick set intimacy, some of the research on it. And so in writing about it, it's a book that's written.
C-L-I-C-K?
C-L-I-C-K.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's written like for a lay audience, and it's things are a little popularized, and the research is stuff that I really haven't yet gone further and looked independently at, and so it's very condensed. But it's written, and it's very interesting, and it makes a lot of sense. I don't know how strong some of the research is, but a lot of it, it sounds very interesting. And what they're trying to say is that generally people think when they first were looking at it. One of the brothers in particular had a research interest in this. People generally think, well, why do you click with the people you click with? And it extends, too, to not just the people you click with, but the projects you click with, the work you click with. And so rather, they said it's sort of popular to think, well, you met the right person, or it was the right moment in time, or something like that. But they wanted to look more at really what are the conditions in situations when people click. So they really did a lot of work on it and looked at other people's work. And they came up eventually, they sort of condensed everything down to there being five ingredients that appear to be correlated with when people click. And then they give the research on each of those ingredients. I thought it was really interesting, and I've used it with some people and that I work with. I mentioned to you today there was a woman that's trying to just feels like she just always is not. She's like a really likable person who strikes out a lot trying to meet somebody, a romantic relationship. So we actually used this as a framework for a little while. And there are these five factors that they call click accelerators, and we're talking about at least one of them. I think really two of them. The first one they talk about is vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And that really is this. It's kind of like beyond how are you and who are you and what do I think of you. It's like that next thing where people share vulnerable things about themselves and where they're really genuine, like they just say things, you know, where it goes beyond that and there is a gut level sharing. And in some cases it's really dramatic and others it's really subtle. But that vulnerability is, they just found over and over again that the presentation of yourself as vulnerable generates, is more likely. All of these are correlated. In fact, it was so interesting that there was one of the research studies had to do with people doing research, how would you say it, interview almost with a computer. And they were wondering whether you could click with a computer. So somebody did research on when a computer interviews you about this, this, and this, and it asks you a lot of things you can answer. And then it asks you things that are more probing, like, can you share something about yourself that you've done that you really feel guilty about? And then they had that done in two different ways. One was the computer that just asked it like that after in a computer-like way. But then this other one, I wrote this down to say in case we got to this. This computer would say when it got to this particular question, there are times when this computer crashes for reasons that are not apparent to its user. It usually does this at the most inopportune time, causing great inconvenience to the user. What have you done in your life that you feel most guilty about? And the answers they got when it was asked in that way were dramatically more revealing than when the computer just asked the question. So I think this sense that there's an opening, yeah. There is space, there's vulnerability there. I can be safe here.
Yeah.
It just has to be there. And I think sometimes with some therapies, people learn them, and especially, of course, when you're first learning them, it's hard to just be yourself, but it's kind of like, how do you open that space at the same time as administering the especially an evidence-based treatment?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Hey, before I forget, just point, Charlie, the other thing that's making me think of is Brené Brown, B-R-E-N-E, Brown, has some great TED Talks on this topic, so people could go to the TED Talks and look up Brené Brown, because she has a great one on vulnerability.
Oh, yeah. I heard about that. Right. I'm going to write it down. Yes, I think there's been two.
There's a new one, too, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going to go. I'll get to those. The other things, by the way, just of interest is people are much more likely to click. It seems obvious, but actually it's not always so obvious, is proximity. You're just more likely to click with people if you sit next to them in school. So actually, in the research on it, people in programs where you sit alphabetically, you can almost predict, you know, that more clicking, more connecting, more getting close relationships is going to happen between people close to each other in the alphabet because of where they're sitting. I mean, it's really, according to this research, it's replicated. And or where you are in a dorm. I mentioned this today, but they looked at a police academy that had 45 men, and they all were in a dorm while they were doing a certain intensive part of their training. And the ones who lived in the middle of the dorm, as opposed to out down the hallway, like the outcomes in terms of relationship networking was that the people who lived at the ends of the hallways were, you could really predict that they were probably going to be outsiders. And the ones right in the middle were going to be among the more popular people. And they weren't placed based on their own preferences. They were placed just by, you know, random. So things like that, proximity.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I wonder if that means you should actually move people around in group to strengthen group cohesion or something. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting.
Or frequency of, I mean, because what it really has to do with the people you have proximity to, not only do you do your formal work with them or next to them, but you also, they're the ones that when you sit down and class hasn't started, or the ones in the middle of the hallway that say, what happened to your sister?
Yeah.
I heard that your sister, you know, was pregnant. Oh, yeah. You just, these little conversations get going, I think, before group, during break at group.
Yep.
That are like really the stuff that holds the group together. It's like the glue, the social glue. So, but I recommend, you know, take a look at some point at that book. The funny thing is, as I told you, I thought you recommended it to me, and you haven't read it, so that's pretty weird. That's so you and me are on the same page and equally out of it.
That's great.
Yes. There's another one called Resonance, which is really all about being mindful. I mean, they never use that word, but you're more likely to click with people when you're giving undivided attention and mutuality and attentiveness. And so they summarize some of that. And when you go through adversity together, I mean, it's almost like a recipe for certain types of therapy. Proximity, you know, mindful attention, go through adversity together. Yeah.
That's really interesting. I'll get that. Yeah, the other thing.
No, I tell the Lone Ranger and Tonto, it was that they saved each other's lives. I had forgotten that, but the Lone Ranger saved Tonto's life when Tonto was a boy. And then they came back together when the Lone Ranger was shot, but all of the other Rangers were killed, but he was still breathing. And Tonto found him and dragged him back to the teepee and nursed him back to health. So, you know, the proximity, the clicking, what was going on there. and they're still together as far as I know. Hey, you said something this afternoon that you haven't said anything about, and I was looking forward to hearing. So let me see where I wrote it. It was about, it was something about an astrophysicist. Is that at all connected to what we're talking about, or is that a totally different loop?
Let's see. This is Neil deGrasse Tyson, who I am falling in love with. He is an astrophysicist. Is it connected? I could sort of work my way out there. I guess the way that it connects, this will be convoluted, Charlie. You ready?
So
that,
I'm ready.
The way that
I'm
it wrong. Actually connects.
I'm always ready for that.
The way it connects is sometimes, you know, I think about starting things. This is actually how it genuinely connects, but it may be a little loose here. So it's scary, you know, like starting new projects and that, or the threat of rejection. You know, I'm just thinking about, like, how hard is it to be the one that first sticks out your hand and says, hi, I'm Kelly, you know, when you're in that kind of social situation, at least for me as a shy person. Mm-hmm. And in these moments when I'm starting, a lot of times what's helpful is to somehow get perspective. And so what I do is the Hubble Space Telescope has these great pictures of the universe, you know, so like stars and stars and stars and galaxies and galaxies and galaxies. And so this is how I came across Tyson and deGrasse Tyson. And one of his quotes that I read today was, you know, when I realized that these particles from distant suns have actually, we're made of those. You know, they have traveled, all the light has traveled, and my actual body is composed of these stars. When I realized that, he says, I feel like I want to run up to people on the street. Did you know this?
Right. I highly recommend that.
But there's
so downtown Seattle.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. But there's something about, you know, when I feel small, or when I'm feeling scared, or, you know, that when you want to be bold sort of thing, there's something about that. It's the both of it. It's that there's little particles. It's getting to the little part, but then it's connected to this vast part. There's something about that for me that emboldens me, you know, gives me courage in a strange way. It's like at some deep level, why not? You know, like I am so small. And at some other level, it's like the fact of it, like the universe is inside me. You know, like there's some, it's sort of somehow
really. Well, it makes,
really,
it very makes it very personal.
Yeah, universe, very sweet, you know, dialectic in that, that somehow gives me courage. I think that's what I was, when we were talking about beginnings, I kept thinking of all these, you know, dialectical, you know, these tensions of the tension between like starting small and careful and thoughtful and doing a lot to get it right versus, you know, the opposite of the way in which actually life is prolific and extravagant kind of in the volume. You know, think of a mayfly hatch or something, or if you really want to get a behavior, you want a lot of behavior happening so that you can shape it. And I kept thinking about that kind of a, you know, like this balancing point between these different extremes somehow. Does that make sense?
It makes sense to me.
And that it really varies. It's like you can't, you can't just do one or the other. And I was thinking, too, about teaching with you. There's been times where you started slow. You know, you kind of were hanging back. You were kind of watching. And I'm more of a jump all the way in. Like, I can tell right away if there's a click, you know, with somebody. I kind of just like, sure, we could go drive across the country. Yes, I met you 2 minutes ago, but I can tell. You know, like that. That emotion.
But I don't think of you that way at all.
Really?
I'm now seeing that. But
yeah.
But that's that kind of jumping in. I don't know if it's an increase in wisdom or a decrease in brain cells, but I do more and more of that than I used to. Definitely in teaching. If I think that there, you know, I think it was partly, it's just a long learning process, but it did include learning things from Cindy Sanderson, because she was a jump in kind of person, in a teaching way, at least when she taught with me.
It
does help. You almost never,
modeling.
You almost never go wrong. I mean, you make mistakes and you say stupid things, but there is something about just, yeah, modeling. Okay, let's try this. Let's try this. You know, playing the Lone Ranger today. I mean, going back to that. And then I thought, Jesus, that was a stupid thing to decide to do. But then I thought, that's just a thought. Who knows?
Yeah.
This could be the perfect thing to do. Maybe the stars are aligned in what's his name's universe, and this is actually something that was scripted a long time ago. It just has to happen. I mean, what I like about what you said about that is that there's a creation of significance, which I think then affects the person you're with. So if you're just thinking that way, you know, then someone else is more likely to be affected by the significance of things. I mean, what I thought when you said that, I thought, gee, do you remember The Lion King, the movie when Mufasa, the father, is one of his last conversations before he dies. He's talking to Simba, and he takes him to a mountain, and he says, look at the stars. Those are our ancestors, and creates this really great moment in the movie of how that, you know, that's where I'll be, you know, and that's where you'll be, and that's where we all are. And it just, you know, in a different way than you're talking about it more astrophysically, and they're talking about it more as a Disney movie. But it worked in both places. I know we're almost have to stop. I wonder about the capacity of some people to just when people can appreciate that kind of thing. Because my son, one of my sons, just when I was driving him to high school the other day, he's doing something he's never done before. I mean, and I know him pretty well. I've been in a million car rides with him to hockey tournaments and high school and everything. And, you know, he's just in the last couple of weeks saying, "Dad, look at the sky. God, it's beautiful this morning." And I think, oh, I love that he's thinking that. And I don't think he was capable in a certain way of thinking of it before. And then on the way home from school one day last week, he said, "Dad, do you realize that if you do something right now, like if you were to run over something on the street here, it could affect something in India pretty soon." I thought, God, I love this. You know, he's not been that kind of person, but it's kind of like opening up, and those connections would make it possible to, you know, just have such a greater richness. And it's like a new beginning.
It is a new
beginning. I noticed the time, Kellyanne. Perry's probably about to let us know, but it's already 9 o'clock Eastern time. I realize you're still probably not had dinner yet.
Yeah, it's just coming up on 6, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I think we're going to have to stop. And for anybody still listening, we'll, you know, I think tune into the website, both for the next date is already set, but then the next topic isn't set. And also we want to invite people, you know, to send emails in to Perry, at least for now. We'll think of in the future of how we want to get input. But even though we want to just focus on our own conversation when we do this, we're also very interested to know whether it's interesting and whether there would be interesting things that people would want to have us look into or talk about. So there you go.
The more feedback, the better.
That's fun. Yeah. Kelly, thank you. You know, I'll speak for me. It's a unique opportunity because it feels a bit like eavesdropping, and also being blessed to listen to the thinking of both of you and sort of feel like, well, I don't have to say anything, but I can just listen and just learn. So there have been a lot of people on the call, and I do also encourage them to send us emails and share what this experience has been like, because I think we're all learning to see how we can work with this. But for me, I get to speak, so I just want to let you know that it was a wonderful experience to watch two minds sort of going back and forth, and I hope that it was okay for both of you.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It just feels like a small slice. We could go a long time.
Well, and I think the rest of us would encourage you to do that, but we won't impose on your time. But the way you were both so free with your thoughts and open was role modeling for, I'll say, for me, and I'm sure for other people on the call as well.
Thanks, Terry.
So last words you'd like to share with us or something you'd like us to think about? We will be posting this call so other people might also send us emails, but anything you'd like us to think about over the month?
I had a Thich Nhat Hanh quote that for me speaks to beginnings that I would read, Perry. That would be mine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, go ahead.
Please.
Yeah, waking up this morning, I smile. 24 brand new hours are before me. Mm. I vow to live fully in each moment and to look at all beings with eyes of compassion. Just love the idea of starting each day. Yeah.
Can you send us, I'm wondering, you both mentioned some books, if you could send them to me in an email.
Sure.
I'll post them on the website, and also that that quote, too.
Sure, yeah.
Thank you. Charlie, did you want to end with your gambler, or did you want to save that?
Oh, I don't think we have enough time for that, do we? We're past 9.
It's up to you. We can do it, or we can save it for another time.
I would sing that if you want me to, but I don't know if people want to. Well, we can't really ask. This is like a different format. I'll sing it, and then we'll stop.
Okay.
I ended one other thing on here with that.
Okay,
so here it is. Kenny Rogers, DBT as gambler. On a warm summer's evening, on my way back from treatment, I met up with a gambler. His game was DBT. We took turns a-talking about how things were going, whether I was changing through my therapy. He said, son, I've made my life out of hearing people's stories, seeing where they're stuck and helping them to see. So if you don't mind my saying, I can see you're going nowhere. If you give me some commitment, I'll try to set you free. Well, I knew he had me going when I had myself committing to try to change my life instead of waiting till I die. And the air grew very still. He sounded so irreverent. Said, if you want to fix your problems, you got to look them in the eye. You got to know when to solve them, know when to soothe them, know when to suck it up, and know when to run. You never make no progress avoiding all the struggles. You got to sit down at the table and join in on the fun. Now every gambler knows that the secret to effectiveness is knowing when to validate and knowing when to fight. 'Cause every day's a good one and every day's a bad one, and the best that you can hope for is to go to sleep each night. So when he finished speaking, he vanished into nowhere. I knew that he had dealt me some cards that I could play. Now every time I hit a wall, think I'm going nowhere, I focus my attention on the words I heard him say. You gotta know when to solve them, know when to soothe them, know when to suck it up, and know when to run. You never make no progress avoiding all the struggles. You gotta sit down at the table and join in on the fun. That's it, Perry.
Well, thank you, and I unmuted everybody so we could all applaud for you, Charlie and Kelly.
Oh, my God, people should have been singing along. Cheryl said that she and her team does this.
So thank you. Thank
you. I suggest we all sing it at Is It DBT next year. You got to learn it. I think it's printed. It's on the website.
It is on the website.
It's written out. So anyway.
Thank you so much.
I hope it was interesting for people. We'll hear about it.
Exactly. We look forward to feedback. Thank you so much, Kelly and Charlie. Have a good night.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye, Kelly.